From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Yes, we're back for another round. Ken Drews and I are, that is, to answer your urgent garden questions as promised in a new monthly doubleheader feature on the A Way to Garden radio show and podcast. Now, it's snowing here like mad, and where Ken is too, so we're all hooked up remotely today in an odd way, so if the sound is a little different, not to be concerned. Readers and listeners have been sending their questions in all month in comments on awaytogarden.com and on my Facebook page and an email. Thanks to all of you who did, and keep them coming, please. So Ken and I have selected a representative sampling to tackle today. But first, I could best describe Ken as my kooky old friend from whom I've learned much about plants over the years, but here's the formal version. He's an award-winning garden photographer and author of more books than I can count, including The New Shade Garden, and he produced his own Real Dirt podcast for 10 years until summer 2016. And the archive of that podcast and much more from Ken is available on his newly relaunched website, kendrews.com. And still available on iTunes as well. So let's welcome Ken and get to those urgent garden questions. How are you?
Okay, well.
Snowman, baby.
It's snow. I'm kooky, just like
okay.
You said, I'm kooky.
You're kooky, good. So we'll hope everything just stays connected. So many questions, oh my goodness. People have been like emailing them in and sending them in and on Facebook and so forth. Let's just do a quick one first before we get some live callers. One from Linda in New Mexico sent a question on Facebook. And this is one I get a lot in the winter and also in very early spring, like when people discover forgotten bulbs in their garage.
Oh, wow.
So she said, have I waited too long to plant one garlic and two parrot tulip bulbs? What do I do now? She's in Albuquerque. With a weird winter, she says, of both snow and freezing temps and very mild weather. Help, please. Mm. Now, I know what I told her. I said, can you dig a hole still? And if so, why not? What do you have to lose? What would you do with them?
Well, garlic, I think that's okay.
Yeah.
That's not such a problem because usually you can plant them in December and we're not that far off December. But just like you said, you want to throw them out or you might as well try.
Right.
And you can, if you can dig a hole, if you can get into the ground, I'd say to plant those tulip bulbs, or perhaps you could try to force them. Because, you know, a lot of people who live in California have to refrigerate their bulbs if they want their tulips to bloom at all. So there's still a chance, I'd say, either plant them in the ground or pop them up, keep them in a cool place, 40 to 50 degrees until it shoots, then bring them into a sunny window and see what happens.
Yeah. I think better than wasting, just give it a try. Yeah, I agree.
Sure, give it a try.
I agree. Now,
you know, she might want to soak those bulbs before she plants them, just saying, in case they dehydrated. But what were you going to say? Go ahead.
No. That's good. And actually, that's funny that you say that, because that is the thing, is they start to desiccate. They start to sort of dry up, don't they? They kind of shrivel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And of course, both things that she's talking about, tulips and garlic, they want to use the fall when we normally plant them, if we didn't forget them in the garage. They want to use the fall before the ground freezes to set down roots. That's what they're kind of hoping to do. So fingers crossed. So I think that Marshall, our engineer and friend here, I think that he hopefully has hooked in a caller. And is Kirsten on the line from Connecticut?
I am, yes. Hello.
Oh, my goodness. It's a miracle of modern technology. We're all hooked up.
I can hear.
All right.
It's great.
Ken's connection sounds a little different because we're all hooked together today, Kirsten, because of the snow by Skype and, oh, my goodness, and chewing gum. So sorry about any technical stuff. I should tell people that you attended my 365-day garden webinar recently, and you had a question afterward. So the context is that you were listening to me give a talk, a slide lecture, about kind of making a four-season garden and so forth. And so you had a question that came from that. What is it?
Yes, my question concerns 365-day structure in the garden. Mm-hmm. And that is, how do I mix a border planting so there's structure in the winter, but also space for summer perennials?
Right. So structure, you mean that you want woody, vertical, you know, you want woody accents, you want shapes and form.
Yes, like woody, yeah. I mean, I would refer to them as woody shrubs, small woody yeah. shrubs, so that I'm currently not seeing this flat, barren border in my garden.
Right. Okay.
And I'm in 6B, so I leave my cutback as late as I can, but eventually, if I left it too long, it would be flattened by the snow.
Right. I'm down to almost nothing here, too. So to have room, I mean, and I'm going to let Ken tackle this sort of the plant combination aesthetic stuff. But one thing that I would say is that this is harder to do in beds and borders that are narrower versus very wide. In my experience, I have more success with making sort of a four-season planting when I have more room to work with than when I have everything sort of cheek to jowl,
oh, yeah.
if you know what I mean. Because,
yeah.
yeah. So one thing that I've noticed is that in my widest beds, I do a better job. And they're sort of now in their maturity, 25, 30 years in, some of them are 25 years old. They are more like shrubberies with the herbaceous layer. And so when the herbaceous layer collapses, like you say, after a bunch of snows, I've still got that backbone or that center sort of spine running down them of the shrubs.
Yes.
If the beds were narrow, I would never have been able to accommodate that. And frankly, the beds got wider as the shrubs got bigger. And that's how I learned that lesson. Oops. How wide are your beds that you're talking about?
I think currently they're probably, the one in particular is like 7 to 8 feet
right.
deep,
right.
and it's more yeah. of a hummingbird garden.
Yeah.
So yeah. the only structure now is the post that the feeder hangs on.
Right.
and it's it drives me crazy.
yeah. So that was what I was having ESP there, and I was imagining that your beds were wider than, say, 12 or 15 feet, narrower than, say, 12 or 15 feet, because my big wide ones are the ones where I have a better backbone. But, Ken, what about you? What do you think?
12 or 15 feet, that sounds pretty deep. I think 8 feet sounds like a lot with that. You may have to remove some of the perennials to get some shrubs in and then put them back or put them someplace else. But since you're talking about winter and winter interest, I think that some of the colorful twig dogwoods and willows would be great. One of my favorites is the Cornus sanguinea midwinter fire, which has sort of sunset colored twigs, and that you cut it back every other year, cut back the oldest wood. So it would probably be 3 to 4 feet tall. And then there's a lot of willows with colorful bark that people seem to ignore. One whole set is Salix alba variety Vitellina britzensis, which is the coral bark willow.
Ken,
there's a gazillion deciduous.
You yeah. just broke up for a second. Say the name of that plant again, just for us.
The willow,
yeah.
the coral bark willow.
Yeah.
It's a kind of white Salix, which is a white willow, Salix alba. I know it's a terrible name, variety Vitellina britzensis,
right.
and it's the coral bark willow.
It is beautiful,
That's a cutback plant, too, and that'll grow 5 to 6 feet tall, and it's very easy to grow. And there's deciduous shrubs like Wigella and Deutzia and Hydrangea, but you're looking for winter interest. So I think that maybe some evergreen shrubs. You could do some vertical evergreen shrubs. If it's in a lot of sun, you can use some of the upright junipers in your zone. You can also use mounding junipers. And if it's a little bit of shade, I think some of the boxwoods are great. Those vertical accents, you know, Margaret, you and I talked about those vestigiate and columnar plants, like boxwood Gram blandi, vestigiata, or D-Runk. Those are some of
right.
the upright boxwoods. And they do take some shade and certainly give you year-round structure.
So I agree with that. With a 7 or 8 foot wide bed, and you want to have some herbaceous layers still, plenty of room for it. I agree. I think some vertical things, some columnar things like that are, as Ken says, vestigiate, more narrow. Kirsten, I think those would be really dramatic and placed not like soldiers in a row, of course, but more like punctuation and a little unexpected.
Well, that was the next question was, it sort of segues into, there's lots of talk about which plants to use.
Yeah.
But another challenge that I have is how to arrange them. I mean, I have, you know, I know it should be sort of a loose matrix, this sort of amoeba-like matrix, but I always struggle with the spacing and the grouping. You know what I mean?
Right. I definitely just, I think at all costs avoid the soldiers unless we're, you know, something that looks mathematically calculated, unless it's a very, very formal garden and unless it's meant to be like a hedge, like a screen at the back of a border. You know, everybody always says buy odd numbers of things, but sometimes buy odd numbers plus one and put the other one farther down the bed and have a cluster at the other end. Or I don't know, I kind of like odd groups, you know.
Threes and fives. And I was just thinking the same thing. You can group three of these vertical things together in one spot and then further down the border or closer in, you could do one or two to repeat it, kind of echo it.
Right. So I hope that's a little bit of help. I agree. Twig dogwoods. I love, Ken mentioned some of the ones he loves. I love silver and gold, which has white variegated leaves during the growing season and then has gold twigs in the off season. And I also love Cornus cerisea sunshine, which has gold leaves in the season, in the warm season, and incredible red twigs in the winter. So those are two other favorites. And there are some willows that look okay too. Some of them get kind of big and you'd have to cut them back pretty every other few years. Otherwise they'd overtake. But there are a lot of willows that also have that characteristic. So I appreciate the question, and thank you again for attending the webinar. It was nice to meet you through that. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm just looking to see what piles of questions I have here next. maybe we'll do one little real quickie. Let me see. What's a juicy little quickie? Kathy in Pawling, New York, she said, so the redbud I bought on sale about 15 years ago had several of its main branches split, so she had to take it down. But in its place are several suckers. Will any of them grow into a new tree or shrub or what? You had this happen to you, didn't you?
I did. A big branch of a white pine fell on my beautiful young white-flowered redbud, and it broke just about 10 inches off the ground. And it's alive and doing very well, but it's a multi-stemmed small tree, kind of like you might see for a crab apple or something like
that.
So what you can do, and what maybe I should have done, is choose one and get it back to be a tree again. So you choose perhaps the strongest sucker or the most vertical one, and you'd have to cut off the other suckers down to the ground, and you probably have to do that for a couple of years because they'll keep coming up for a couple of years. But then you could encourage it to be a tree again. If you would like a multi-stem giant shrub, you can just let it go and thin any cross branches or if it gets congested and, you know, shape it the way you'd like it to look. But it'll come back.
Right. And the only other hesitation is if it was a grafted redbud.
Oh, I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah. Right.
Like the white one. Yes, it broke above the graft.
Right. So that's the other thing she should be on the lookout for. So, Ken, we actually have a caller from North Carolina next. Charity, are you on the line?
I am.
And your voice sounds very familiar, miss.
That's right. You used to be my boss.
We used to work together, and it was so hilarious that out of the blue comes an urgent garden question from one of my ex-colleagues who now has relocated to North Carolina. What's your question?
My question is about stink bugs. Ooh. Every year, they come in and they just decimate the whole garden. And I've only been gardening for 3 years now out of all of my years. I've always lived in cities. And so this is my first attempt, and I'm trying to not just spray them with all the poisons, but then at the end, it's just a race to either harvest the zucchini before the stink bugs eat all the vines. So what can I do to stop them?
You know, this was a funny question. This really got me going and thinking about stink bugs, and got me going in so many different directions. It was like this journey thinking about your question, because one of the things that I always have to do when I see insect pests in the garden, unless I'm absolutely 100% certain what they are, is be very careful not to misidentify them, or to identify them just by their common name. Like, say, I don't know if, for instance, a neighbor might have told you the name of these bugs, or did you look them up? How did you figure out what they were?
I feel like my husband told me. He's from Florida.
Yeah. So the thing about stink bugs, which is sort of a generic term, right, is that there's 5,000 species in the world. So it's kind of like saying, do you know what I mean? It's one of those, it's like saying bird.
Right.
It's a little more precise than that, than bird. But in other words, so there's so many different stink bugs, and making things even more complicated. And you just said the vining crops, right? They're bothering your squash, right?
Yeah.
And of course, a near lookalike, another bug, and it's kind of a cousin. It's not in the same family, but I think it's in the same order and suborder of insects that look something like it, are called squash bugs. And they also stink if you squish them. So now our head is really spinning, right?
Right.
So one thing I would say, and not that we won't talk about stink bugs, but what's happened is, and what happens to me is, I read about, you know, everybody's talking about particular kind of stink bugs that have become more prevalent, especially this one called the brown marmorated stink bug, which is an Asian pest that got introduced accidentally years ago in Pennsylvania and has since migrated. And I know it's in your area and many other areas already. And it's getting all the headlines. But it's not so common a pest of the cucurbits, the squash and the pumpkins and the cucumbers. It's more common in other crops, fruits like apples and some grapes, I believe, tomatoes. This is where I kind of wonder, is this a stink bug? And if so, which stink bug? And so, without sounding like a crazy person, I actually love this site called bugguide.net. And I actually take pictures of my insects. I'll capture one and put it in a little container and take close-up pictures of the top and the bottom of the bug, and really try to make sure I'm IDing it, because to come up with a control method, we have to know exactly who it is and what its life cycle is and so forth. So I have a couple of questions. So are they shield-shaped? And by that I mean almost as wide as they are long, or are they a little more elongated, like maybe a third as wide or half as wide as long? The shape of the bug.
I would say more shield. They look like, like a little turtle almost. They're like...
Okay, so that's more like a stink bug. Do they come in your house?
No.
That's what's sweet. That's weird, because the brown marmorated stink bug, and why it's gotten all the headlines, is that unlike our native stink bugs, they love to come in our houses. So they love to take cover, and will even come into residences. And so people see them in the wintertime. And so that, if you have such a big infestation, I would think you'd also be seeing them in your house, you know, in the winter.
Almost like, it's really temporary. It's almost like they have a bat signal. They just come in, here they come, they eat all the plants, and then they leave.
Well, so whether they're squash bugs or stink bugs, here's what I'm going to suggest. I'm going to suggest planting a trap crop, which is something that organic farmers do a lot, and other farmers as well, to sort of lure them elsewhere as one tactic. You've tried some sprays, have you, and so forth?
Yeah, I have neem, and I've sprayed that on, and I think it was too late, for that.
So the best time to spray for the least toxic, to use the least toxic substance, and even like an insecticidal soap, if you could find the eggs, you'd probably be able to damage those by spraying a very low toxicity You know, once we have the little hardened sort of shells and so forth, it gets harder to kill them, and the insecticides recommended get to be much more scary.
Okay.
So, but the idea to trap them, to lure them to another plant that you don't mind if they eat, or another planting of these desirable crops at a distance that you don't mind that they eat, that are planted at a slightly different time. And I actually do this a lot. Like, I will plant an earlier, I'll plant my squash in two batches, not because I've lost the first batch, but because I know I'll have some insect pressure at some point, and they'll decide which one they like better, but they won't take both generations. Does that make sense? So I'll plant at a distance. I'll plant another a related crop or the same crop, but weeks apart, a couple or a few weeks apart. And inevitably, they will pick, like I said, they'll pick the younger or the older crop, not both. So a trap crop, if it is brown marmorated stink bugs, you can also use okra as a trap crop, speaking of southern vegetables.
Okay.
Because they love that. So, again, before you put out, you know, you can wait a little while, not put out your squash quite so early, and try to attract the pests to a trap crop.
Okay.
But first, we've got to identify really what they are, so we know the right trap crop. We know vining crops will work. And kind of know what other tactics will work. Generally speaking, with both of these insects, row covers can help. Have you tried those at all?
No.
So when you plant, when you set out your transplants or sow your seeds, to put Rimae lightweight or Agrabon lightweight fabric and over the row. And with enough room in it, weighted down, pinned down with what they call earth staples, but and probably stretched over hoops, so that the plants can grow up inside them. And the key here, though, is you don't want to do it in the place where you planted the squash last year, because there may be some overwintering.
Okay.
You know, yeah, you want to like rotate the area. So those are some tactics. We gotta get a good ID on these insects for sure. We're gonna consider row covers, trap crop, depending on who it is, planted earlier and nearby, but not right alongside. So like a staggered crop, one to be as the lure away from the desired crop.
Okay.
So yeah. All right. Well, good. I'll put more. I found some really good links for you, and I'm gonna put those on the transcript of the show. And I thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
Nice to talk to you.
Okay, you too.
And nice
to
talk
Margaret,
to you.
Know, Margaret, are we out of time?
Yeah, I think so.
I just wanted to quickly say that turning the bug over and photographing the underside was a really good suggestion.
Absolutely. Let's get all the views. So thanks to all of you for tuning in. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. You can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or at facebook.com/awaytogarden. Happy gardening meantime, and stay tuned, because we're going to keep talking. We're going to take more calls. We're going to have the double header session in just a minute. Over time.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.
Ken, you still there, Ken?
Oh, I'm alive.
Okay, good. Good, good, good. Do you have squash bugs or stink bugs? Maybe you don't grow squash.
Well, I don't grow squash. Well, sometimes I grow pumpkin, actually. But I do have stink bugs, and sometimes indoors, but they're not the Asian marmorated.
Me neither. The ones that I have indoors are actually, I believe, a squash bug, oddly enough.
Really?
Yeah, well, they're elongated. I've been trapping them like mad and looking at them, keying them out.
I have to go to bugguy.com.
Bugguy.net.
.net, sorry. And mine look exactly like the Asian marmorated, except that's why I was wondering about the underside, because one of them has a sort of chartreusey green underside, and one of them has a brown underside. So there's lots of ways to try to tell them apart, but that's an easy way, unless you get stinked.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. What was
that? I guess turning them over is a little tricky.
Okay. So questions. We have more questions. We have Christina on Facebook asked a question. She's worried about oaks and the connection to ticks. And she says, I wonder if you'd recommend removing a huge pin oak tree that grows 20 feet from our house. She's concerned about the roots, but also the rodent slash tick issue. Should we replace and plant another oak on our 2-acre property for the animals and nature, but how far away from the house? So she's concerned about two things. 20 feet from the house, she has a big oak tree, a pin oak tree, and she's concerned about the roots, but then she's concerned about rodents and ticks. I don't think that's too close to the house, do you?
No, I don't.
No,
especially because oaks tend to have deeper roots, you know, like tap roots, more than something like a maple that would have roots close to the surface.
Right, right. So my feeling was, and I believe I may have answered her on Facebook as well, is that I would never take down an oak tree because they're such high value trees for the environment. For, you know, they are sustenance for so many creatures. They're so much like the part, a big part of the support of the web of life, so to speak. So I treasure the oak trees here. I understand what she's talking about, which is that in about the sort of oak, the acorn slash tick connection. And I have interviewed scientists at the Carey Institute in Millbrook, New York, where they've been studying for 25 years or something, the connection between oaks and ticks and gypsy moths and so on and so forth, and the populations, how they're affected. In an oak bumper year, when you have a mast year, you know, when you get a lot of acorns, you get a lot of food for lots of animals and birds, including mice. You get more mice and more chipmunks. Mice and chipmunks are sort of the vectors, the carriers of, if a tick bites them, they infect the tick. Ticks are born without Lyme or any of those diseases. It's the mouse in their blood or the chipmunk in their blood that most likely infects the tick. And so I understand what she's saying. She's like worried to have more acorns feeding more mice and chipmunks and infecting more ticks and exposing herself and her family to Lyme. But I think the value of having an oak tree far outweighs that. And I don't think that's what to worry about. So that's just my two cents.
Yeah. She also mentioned squirrels, and I've never heard squirrels being sort of the alternate host. I mostly heard, just like you said, mice and chipmunks.
Yes. Yes. And not voles, which you'd think, well, don't they fit in there too? No, no, it's not them. So it's creatures of the leaf litter, which chipmunks and, you know, mammals, small mammals, rodents of the leaf litter tend to be. And so it's chipmunks and white-footed mice in our eastern forests. So should we talk to Susan in Virginia, who has a question? Is Susan on the line?
I am on the line.
Oh, it's a miracle.
I'm actually not in Virginia, though.
Oh, you're not
in
Virginia.
I'm in upstate New York.
You're upstate New York. Oh,
yes.
How did I put you in Virginia?
Oh, it's my email address.
Oh, okay.
Oh, don't worry.
Okay. We won't say that out loud on the air, though. We won't give
it's
away.
It's amazing.
That's funny. So you
well,
have a
I
question
wanted to,
for us.
I wanted to ask about sourcing information for flowering shrubs. I was hoping to put in a hedge of viburnum and juneberry and spicebush, but I don't really know where to actually get them.
Okay. And you said you're in upstate New York, not in Virginia.
That is correct.
You know, I'm going to ask you to talk about some of your favorite sources, but before we do that, I want to put in a pitch for making friends with your best local woody plant nursery. And by that, I mean going around and seeing who has nurseries that look like they have interesting things and going to the counter and speaking to whomever's really in charge, especially the owner, and saying, hey, I'm interested in getting some different things. How do you order things for customers? And will you let me know what things you have access to wholesale? I thankfully, like 30 years ago, made friends with a woody plant nursery owner maybe 20 or 30 minutes from me. And I'm telling you, I've learned so much from him over the years. And I also learned that nurseries are happy to help you get anything if they can find it in the trade. You know, they have trucks coming in late winter, early spring, and during the year to stock their shelves, so to speak, to stock their nursery. And they can get almost anything that's out there in the wholesale trade. So again, making friends, it's not going to work at a big box store to do that, but with the best possible nursery within an hour or so of you, if there is such a place, and really going up and saying, help me, you know, help me get things that maybe I don't see here in your assortment. And I like to do that as soon as they're answering the phone again in winter or the fall before. And I've gotten really unusual things that way. So I just want to put in that pitch for that.
Well, I think that that's a great idea. And the plants that Susan mentioned are not that unusual.
Right. But they may be where she lives.
And sometimes. But I think that, you know, any nursery should want to do that because they're going to make money.
Right.
You know, so there's an incentive for them as well. And if the plants are native plants, then there's a lot of government projects of plantings and restoring areas. So those plants are kind of around.
Right. So what are some of your favorite, dare we mention? I mean, you know that when I have my open garden days, I have my friends from Broken Arrow Nursery in Connecticut come, and they have great stuff, and they stock all the things you're talking about. Susan, not in Virginia. and they do mail order as well. I mean, obviously the limits of mail order are that things are going to be smaller that come to you in the mail. But I do still mail order things. So that's one place that is obvious to me as an example. Other places, Ken, that.
Well, when we started the garden here 20 years ago, we got almost everything through the mail, but there were a lot more sources 20 years ago when people were collecting plants. And Broken Arrow, of course, is great. Quackengrass, have you ever used them in Connecticut? They're another good mail order place. Uh-huh. Rare Fine Nursery in New Jersey has good sized plants in their mail order. If you have unlimited resources, as far as Farm Nursery in Oregon, their plants aren't that expensive and they do have big ones, but the shipping will kill you.
Right. Forest Farm is amazing. The list is crazy. It's wonderful.
Unbelievable.
But again, as Ken says, they're going to ship it all the way across the country, and that's going to cost you, which is another reason I love to make friends with the local nursery and ask if they can help me. And I come in with crazy lists, Susan, so I don't be shy. I mean, and I say to them, can you get me? And I mean, right down to the cultivar, I'll say, you know, I don't just want a clethra. I want this particular clethra, this dwarf one with the exceptional flowers and blah, blah, blah. And they'll find it for me. Do you have a favorite nursery in your area?
There are a few good ones.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I haven't actually tried asking for some of the very specific ones that I've looked at and learned about a lot from on your blog and website.
Well, that's where I would start, because that's going to spare you the shipping and mean you can put the money into a larger specimen in each case.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Which I always like to do. And if there's something that's super new and rare, then I buy the smaller one by mail order.
Okay.
I don't know if that makes any sense. What I'll do with the transcript, Susan, is I'm going to include a list of Ken's and my, each of our favorite resources, including the few that we just mentioned. But, you know, there's quite a number more that we both use and have gotten great things from over the years. So I'll share that on the transcript of this show. I'm so glad for your call, though. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for answering my question.
Nice to speak to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So, Ken, I was going to ask you actually a question that I got from actually two people this week, which was about damping off and preventing damping off when the fungal disease that can kill or does kill seedlings, young seedlings, when we've sown our seed, which some people are sowing their leeks. They've been writing in and saying, I sowed my leeks, I sowed my onions. So some people further to the south are sowing are ahead of what we're doing. Yeah, exactly. And it can be really devastating to lose your whole flat of seedlings to damping off, and they just kind of collapse. Do you have any like secret like remedy for this? Or I mean, obviously it can't be remedied. I shouldn't say that, because once it happens, it's...
Well, yeah, I do. I used to always have damping off. I would, especially with tomatoes, you know, so they come up, they look great. They're about an inch tall and they start to keel over. And damping off is a name that they give to a series of fungal diseases that attack young seedlings. And, you know, if you're looking at the stem, it kind of collapses a little bit and turns brown close to the medium surface. And then that's it. That's the end, especially if you don't have the true leaf, the first leaf that resembles what the adult leaves are going to look on the plant. And about 20 years ago, when I was writing Making More Plants, my book on propagation, I tried different methods of doing everything. And one thing that I did with all of my seeds and seed sowing was top dress them with a thin layer of either chicken grit, and Margaret, I know you know what that is, or very coarse horticultural sand. And both of those are a little weird to find. Chicken grit, if there's any ag supply place near you, you can find chicken grit, because you can't have chickens without chicken grit. And usually it's flaked granite. Sometimes in coastal areas, it's flaked and chopped up oyster shell. You don't want that. You want it to be stone. And I put a 1-3 grain layer on the surface of my sowing medium with the seeds either under, or if they're seeds that are tiny or need light to germinate, I sprinkle the seeds after I put that little bit of grit or very coarse sand on the top. And for 20 years, I should knock on wood, I have not had damping off again.
So and basically mulching your seedling flats with a little bit of...
Actually in 3.5-inch square plastic
pots. Right,
pot.
Okay. Whatever. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're sowing in community pots and small pots or and then you're mulching the surface, so to speak, with this chicken grit from the farm supply store or coarse sand. Is that what you said?
Well, horticultural coarse sand, it's not as easy to find, but it's very coarse. It's a little bit bigger than the parakeet gravel, but I think in a serious pinch, you could use parakeet gravel. I have used it, which they sell in the supermarkets, but sometimes they add things to it, and that's not so great. But what you're doing is you're making an inert, sterile surface. I fill the pots with the medium so that I don't have a reservoir for watering, because you don't water seedlings from the top anyway. You usually water them from the bottom. But sometimes people recommend leaving a 1/4 inch or a 1/2 inch as a place, a reservoir for water. And I think that impedes air circulation a little bit. And then just sprinkle the grit on the surface, and it works.
Okay. All right. So damping off, problem solved. I'm gonna include, I think that you, besides it being in your book, that you, do you have a podcast about that we can link to from the archive so they can get more details?
We probably can, yes.
Okay, good.
So we'll be able to do that.
All right. Well, we've survived the blizzard, and we've answered some questions, and pretty good. Not bad. We didn't like totally lose contact. Now I have to go out and shovel again. I'm glad to speak to you, Ken, as ever. Thank you.
Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you. And thanks to all of you for listening. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free on Stitcher or iTunes to the podcast version, and find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on facebook.com/awaytogarden. And don't forget, on Facebook or on the blog in comments or email through the contact form, send us your questions for a future show. Happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.